This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Across Northern Ireland, on your radio and on BBC Sounds. This is
The Stephen Nolan Show!
On the programme today, we've been talking about Robin Swan's decision to leave the health minister job. Quite reactive, that. There's a video that has emerged of some people chanting songs, celebrating IRA shootings. The PS and I have launched an investigation. Jim Allister's talking to us about that. It's unclear when that video was filmed. It's our understanding the police believe it was at least a number of months ago. And then we talked to Gideon Falter, who is the man at the centre of the storm in London at the weekend, when he's been talking about trying to cross the road during Palestinian protests and the Metropolitan Police telling him that he could be arrested because he was being, quote, openly Jewish. Mr. Falter's on the programme. Lots of people reacting to that as well. So I hope you enjoy this podcast on BBC Sounds from the Nolan Show.
The Stephen Nolan Show!
Good morning, everyone. It's nice to be back. Thank you for your company this morning. Don't forget, we've got the Nolan Show podcast where you can download the programme every single day. Nolan Live's coming up in a couple of weeks' time on BBC One and indeed the iPlayer. And here we are every single day with that most listened to radio show in Northern Ireland, the Nolan Show from the BBC. The Ulster Unionist Party Health Minister, Robin Swan, will leave the Health Minister role after just weeks in the job to chase his ambition to be a Westminster MP. How much of a setback, if any, is that for waiting lists, for example, in Northern Ireland? Robin had previously insisted he could remain in the Health Minister role while campaigning for a seat at Westminster. He was speaking to Crullers, Mark Crullers, on Sunday Politics yesterday. He said he would now be out of the role well before polling day.
My intention wouldn't be to stay right up to polling day because the party will kick in and there'll be other stages as well. So that decision will be made long before the election day is called. It'll be something that'll be made by my party leader. But look...
So during the campaign, you don't see yourself being the Health Minister?
No. And I don't think it would be fair to do that.
Professor Deirdre Heenan from Queen's University with us today. Is this a setback, Deirdre?
Well, I think, well, first of all, Ulster University, I'd better say,
sorry,
or I might get my P45.
Sorry, my fault.
Well, I think, firstly, it is important to say there was shock when the UUP were handed the health portfolio. Remember, this is the biggest issue facing Northern Ireland. I don't think anyone would challenge that. And it accounts for half of the devolved budget. The two biggest parties, DUP and Sinn Féin, never missed an opportunity to tell us about how important health was, why they were going to get Stormont back up and running, because they were going to get Bengoa done, but they sidestepped it. So that's the first thing to say. Secondly, then, when we understood that Robin Swan was returning to the health portfolio, to add insult to injury, we were told very shortly afterwards that he had already agreed and was running for Westminster election. Health is a huge challenge. We've talked about it many times. I don't want to rehearse the problems, but it's also a privilege. It's arguably the biggest job in the devolved government. And the question has to be asked, why did he accept this, knowing that he had already ambitions elsewhere? At a time when the health service was crying out for stability, long-term vision, consistency, leadership, continuity, we end up with a minister in name only, a man who's actually working out his notice. And the fact of the matter is, this is extremely destabilising. It's putting us on the back foot. Who is going to listen to his pronouncements? How can we take him seriously when he has said he wants to go to Westminster? So he told Mark Crullers yesterday he wanted to go to Westminster to be a voice for health for Northern Ireland in Westminster. That is completely ludicrous. Health is fully devolved. It's nothing to do with Westminster. And let's ask yourself, where can you affect change? As a lone voice amongst 650 MPs, or a minister in a devolved government?
You're diminishing the impact an MP can have. It's a big job being an MP, is it not?
No, hold on. Now, let's get real. One MP in the House with 650 others, and it's not that I'm diminishing the role of an MP. The fact of the matter is there are some issues that are reserved, which MPs can have a say on, and there are some issues that are devolved. Health is fully devolved. So if you're seriously asking me to accept that you you don't want to be health minister where you are totally in charge and you're giving this up to go and be a lone voice in Westminster. You know, I think I and the public and the clinicians that I spoke to yesterday and many of them would have much more respect for him if he said, I have a personal ambition to be in Westminster and that is what I'm trying to do. And I am going to turn down the health portfolio, but I will assist the person in the UUP, be that Mike Nesbitt, whoever it is, to help them into the post. I think people would have respected him. Up until yesterday, we did not know if he would continue as health minister while campaigning. Would he step away to campaign and then hope to return if he wasn't successful? Now it seems he will come back as a backbencher if not successful. And clinicians are in despair, saying this is destabilising system at a time when it needs strong leadership, someone who has a long-term vision, someone who is held in respect by the people at the coalface. And I would like to say, Doug Beattie's response was at the time, we want to hit the ground running. This will be a continuity candidate. It has proved to be entirely the reverse. First of all, the idea that he has hit the ground running does not stand up to any scrutiny. And secondly, you cannot help but think, is this about self-promotion, a self-serving appointment to get to your ultimate ambition? Can you run the largest department in Northern Ireland with one eye on a forthcoming general election? I think it's deeply, deeply disappointing.
Stay there. Thomas in Antrim, first call of the day, 030-30-80-55-55. Thomas, good morning.
I would think, Stephen, if you went to a good debating society in a secondary school, we could get better ministers. It seems that every department seems to want £1 billion to fix the sewage works at Duncrew Street, which affects public housing, £1 billion to stand still in health. And they're all career politicians, none of them interested in making the hard decisions.
Well, it's just farcical. It's got to be farcical what you're saying, doesn't it? Just homogenising all of the politicians, all of the ministers, and slagging every one of them off. Like, it is farcical to do that. Isn't it? Isn't it?
Stephen, there's some good guys, but the most of them let themselves down. The majority are in it for themselves.
But where are you getting that from? It is so easy and so cheap, isn't it, to take the political the politicians in this country and slag them all off, and some of them are getting up in the morning and working day and night. Who else do you do that to? What other sector do you do that to?
Probably the civil service. I've worked 60 hours a week in my life.
And you don't think some politicians do?
There's politicians up in Stormont who are cut from the same cloth and they're easy to come from the construction sector, and we work hard and all wellers.
Look,
it's a hard life.
I drive the vast majority of them insane. I get very few Christmas lists, Christmas cards from any of them. I don't want them. It's not my job to be their friends, but what are we going to get in this in Northern Ireland if our default position is to say they're all wasters?
I don't know.
Can I just respond?
Because you can't really vote them out because there is no choice. But what we have is 8 government departments all saying we need £1 billion to stand still, or a fraction of £1 billion, and the solution is not to do efficiencies. Do better government. The solution is always to go to London and say, can we get more money, please? That's not sustainable. After 26 years, we need grown-up politicians making the hard decisions.
Deirdre?
Well, I mean, I agree. It's wrong to say that all politicians are bad and they're in it for themselves. But as an academic, we look at evidence. We are interested in evidence. I know you weren't here last week. But for example, you've got to raise your eyebrow when we are launching a report in Stormont on children's waiting lists, showing the dire state of waiting lists for children, that we have over 6,000 children in Northern Ireland waiting for longer than a year and none in the comparable devolved regions. Not a single minister could turn up to that event in Stormont, yet five executive ministers turned up to the opening of a distillery. I look at that and think, what on earth is going on? How could that decision have been made? I look at, we are promised waiting list strategies. They haven't appeared. We are now told there's going to be a...
Well, now, Robin Swan had ministers' questions when that was being launched, I understand. So there was a genuine clash for him.
Well, he was the sponsor of the event, wasn't he? Can I just respond to that and say, he was offered a different time. The people who were launching the report could not have been more flexible, said, you know, you're in the same building. You can stand in for 10
minutes. Well, he did meet with them, didn't he?
Prior to it, but this is about the optics, about saying what's important to me. Robin Swan has not set out, for example, what are his priorities for this huge portfolio? Is it that he's going to address GP practices, waiting lists, social care? And if so, how is he going to do this? We would have expected at this stage to have a detailed, costed plan on waiting lists. Look to England. They've set up an elective care group with academics, with policymakers, with senior politicians saying, we will have an unrelenting focus on this. You will not be in Northern Ireland and know that there is a hospital that is not being used to 100% capacity because we must clear the waiting list. That's how they did it in England. What we get is hand-wringing, promises of plans, and actually
Deirdre,
no one actually delivering what people need.
Deirdre, hold on a minute. How can you set out a costed plan with no budget in place this year?
Oh no, hold on a minute. First of all, that's like saying, how could I have a mortgage when I don't know what my salary will be next year? Let me assume, and you can come back and tell me if I'm wrong, that there will be a devolved budget next year. Let me assume that half of it at least will go for health. Let me assume that there'll be a 4% uplift, and let's work on those assumptions. May I just say to that, Scotland did not have a multi-year budget. How come they managed to deal with their problems in health and social care? What's the difference? This idea that we need this nice round figure of £1 billion to move forward. We have got £7.2 billion to spend on health. We spend more per head of population than any other devolved region, with by far the worst outcomes. We had a report in 2022 from the Northern Ireland Fiscal Council who said, and I know we talk all the time in this programme about how to raise revenue. They noted serious inefficiencies in our hospital services. They said that our people were spending much longer in hospital, days longer in hospital than comparable patients, that there were problems with governance, accountability, how the hospital estate was run. Where is that report? Where is the action plan to address that report? That report, like all of the reports that went before it, is probably gathering dust in a shelf somewhere. Meanwhile, we will have politicians who will cut ribbons, turn up to nice things, promise us all fluffy bunnies, and as the Royal College of Surgeons said last week, in their despair, people are languishing on waiting lists, dying, knowing that they will never see treatment, that they're being asked to wait 9 years, but in England we're told it's intolerable that anyone should wait longer than 18 months. So let's have a serious plan to address these waiting lists.
Professor Deirdre Heenan, thank you very much indeed. 0303 80 55 55, as Robin Swan announces he is to leave the Health Minister role. George in Guildford. Morning, George.
Good morning, Stephen. I'm a sort of shocked, because it's sort of, this is sort of proves that you can't believe an AMP. Because on your programme years ago, I heard Robin Swan saying that he was going to slow down in politics to have to mind his own family. And then he took on the health minister's job, which was a hell of a job during the time of the troubles.
Things change, don't they?
What's that?
Things change, for goodness sake.
I know, but you stay by your word.
Well, he looked after his family. He looked after a family situation. Then he came back into politics. Then he ran. He was a very popular, people would argue, minister during COVID. What's your problem?
Well, he's staring out now the way. Wouldn't see much of him anyway. I thought a husband was supposed to be half and half of the way.
For goodness sake.
Stephen, it proves
Are you telling me a man can't be an MP now because, quote from you, the wife won't see much of him? What are you on about?
You're not married and you don't know anything about family things.
All right, I don't know anything about family things because I'm not married. I don't understand family because I'm not married. How do you know what my personal situation is?
Well, you're not married and you haven't a family, as far as I know, or less. You must be keeping it dark.
As far as you know.
Well, just to hear this, it proves to me that MPs are like a bunch of bananas. They start off green, then they turn yellow, and there's not a state one among them.
Well, no, you cannot say that.
Well, we're not all. But
yeah, but we're not going to allow you also to say that about Robert Swan. Because a politician is deciding to choose a different political role does not question his integrity one little bit, George. Alex Kane, political commentator. Morning, Alex.
Morning, Stephen.
Is it a sign of how popular, of how good Robin Swan is as a health minister, that we're hearing this frustration from some of our callers that he's leaving?
Well, I think it's a mixture of the two, Stephen, that yes, he was we know from opinion polls that he was a very popular health minister during COVID. Although I think, and I've said this before in your programme, that when after all the COVID inquiries and the reports come out and so on, he may discover that some people say, well, hang on, you made those decisions on what basis? That could be a problem. And the other thing, for everyone who's ever been a health minister will tell you the same thing, Stephen. For every door you knock and somebody says, oh, thank you, good to see you, you'll knock three doors where people say, my granny's still there, my husband hasn't seen, my child's waiting for an appointment somewhere. It may be, there will be moments you can be particularly popular in politics, but when it comes to health, Stephen, popularity is very short term. But one thing I think is worth making in all of this, because Robin has three times, he is the MLA for Northampton. That's still a big job. He's the candidate for Southampton. That's a huge job. He's the Minister of Health. The biggest job in any government department anywhere is always the Minister of Health. The reason he has been selected by the Ulster Unionist Party as a Member of Parliament is that they picked two seats where they thought they had the best chance of winning. They haven't had an MP since 2015. They need an MP. They're desperate to have an MP because it brings influence, it brings money, it brings input or they wouldn't otherwise have. And the two seats they looked at where they think they have the best chance, South Antrim, North Down. South Antrim, right beside Robin Swan. Robin Swan, still popular, known down there. But this was always going to be a nightmare, Stephen, because the minute you take someone like that, had it been any type of minister, in fact, it's just people say, well, how can you be MLA there and how can you be candidate then? How can you be dealing with all of this? And do you know something? Naomi Long is going to get the same problem when it comes to East Belfast, because they know, Alliance know from their figures, we know from other evidence, that she is, if Alliance can take that seat again, it will be done by Naomi Long. They have no other candidate they reckon can take that seat. So she will come under the pressure. And this is what happens when you have people who are good candidates and popular people who also happen to be ministers, because it makes life enormously difficult for them personally. Because if Robin says no, I can't do it, I need to be health minister, that gives then there will be pressure coming on him. But Robin, you're the only one can become an MP. You're the only one that can win this seat. It puts enormous personal pressure. And yes, Stephen, as your previous caller says, it affects MLAs and councillors as well. Being a full-time elected representative, it means time away from your family as well.
What about Nesbitt coming in behind him?
I think that's no big surprise. I think Mike's own preference, I suspect, would have been he would have liked to have been the Speaker. I think he would have liked to see some sort of arrangement between the DUP and the UUP when the Assembly was rebooted, that Poots might go back into some sort of ministry or have some sort of other role, and that the DUP would have nodded Mike through a Speaker. He's not, as far as I know, and if he's listening, or any of his colleagues are listening, as far as I know, he is not slated in anywhere as a candidate. So if Robin is to stand up, which he has to at some point, Stephen, he will at some point have to make a decision. He can't say, I'm a candidate, but I'll keep on and on and on, because the minister has to be full-time. He has to be able to go on journeys. He has to be able to make decisions. He has to be able to stand and the Assembly. He has to be able to go to all the meetings that Deirdre was talking about that they don't always get a chance to. Nesbitt, of the eight MLAs that the Ulster Students Party has available to it, and it's all the numbers game, Stephen. Of the eight available, Mike Nesbitt, I suspect, is their only viable option to replace Swan.
Alex, thank you. Morning to you. 030 30 80 55 55. Tony's in Port Stewart. Morning, Tony.
Morning. Stephen, you need to calm down.
What do you mean?
You're shouting at them, man.
What do you mean?
I mean, you're shouting.
Well, that man told me I don't understand family because, what, I'm not married?
No, but there was before that.
What patronising is that?
It's before that you were doing it. You know, you just need to calm down, Stephen.
Well,
you're only back.
Yes, I am only back, and my heart rate is up there already. Like, how patronising is that? You're not married. All of a sudden, you've got to be married. Do you understand the world, do you?
No. That wasn't that comment that I'm talking. You're just shouting at everybody.
You think I should whisper?
Just talk normally.
Okay.
Be nice. Try and be nice again.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tony. Keep listening.
Bye.
Good morning. Bye. David Graham, former DUP Special Advisor. Good morning, David.
Stephen, good morning. Welcome back.
Thank you very much. I have a wee sneaky suspicion that Tony's one of those people, doesn't like me shouting, but listens every day. Let's get back to Robin Swan. Is this a betrayal of the people who want him to sort out waiting lists? Is it a betrayal of those people who trusted him, endorsed him, want them to sort out the biggest department in the country?
I'm not necessarily sure if I would agree that it's a betrayal, but it's certainly a miscalculation and a gross miscalculation at that from the Ulster Unionist Party. I mean, you know, this is not a surprise in that, or certainly it can't have been a surprise where any party worth its salt is starting to plan for the next election as soon as the previous one is over. So clearly the Ulster Unionist Party have decided for some time, and we're public about it, that Robin Swan would run in South Antrim. The issue then arises that he comes in you know, with great fanfare, and I think justifiably so, given his performance, particularly during the COVID-19 crisis as health minister. And then all of a sudden, the rug seems to be pulled from everyone, because he's now going to, at some point, step down. And I think that's the real problem, is that, you know, they're compounding the issues here because...
Well, you say that. Sorry to interrupt, David. But you take the likes of Paul Given, a minister. He could be a DUP candidate in the general election as well.
He could be, and I suspect he probably won't be. But of course he could be, and certainly... Robin Swan won't be the first government minister to then run in an election. However, the challenge is, you know, we are months, in fact, we're probably only weeks into Stormont restarting in the current mandate. And I think, you know, the issue is, had it been years, for example, Stephen, there maybe would have been more justification. But, you know, clearly this was either part of a plan which someone somewhere thought, well, this will be a good idea because Robin Swan has got a high profile. But I think the fear is now, from the Ulster Unionist Party point of view, you know, Paul Girvan's a very good candidate. He's a really good reputation as an MP. He won the seat from the Ulster Unionists. And I think, you know, it was going to take a really strong campaign from Robin Swan to unseat Paul. Now, he still may do so, Stephen, but I think the issue is that this will, you know, leave a sort of lingering stench throughout the campaign, that he's left the health ministry without a minister, or certainly or replaced a minister, I should say.
John Tong's joining us as well. David, thank you. Good morning to you. 0303 80 55 55. Professor of Politics at Liverpool University, John Tong. A lot of public reaction to this morning, John.
Well, I'm in a minority here, but I think Robin Swan has made the right decision. The Ulster Unionist Party needs Westminster seats. The Ulster Unionist Party has always valued the Westminster link more than the DUP. The DUP is a regional devolutionist party at heart. The UUP is desperate to get back to Westminster. It made perfect sense for the Ulster Unionist Party to put Robin Swan in a constituency where he has a good chance of winning. In fact, I might even make him favourite to capture the seat. There's only 2,600 votes in it. Why wouldn't you use one of your most high-profile MLAs who's done his term? He's done his time now as health minister.
So why did he take it again then?
Well, because no other party wanted it, let's be honest. The health ministry, what an utter poison chalice. I mean, he said yesterday, and he wasn't crying wolf, he needed £1 billion. Stand still, and standing still in a Northern Ireland context means you're behind the rest of the United Kingdom in terms of waiting lists, in terms of cancer referrals, etc.
Is it the case that it might be good for the UUP, but is it good for the country?
Well, I mean, there are other MLAs that are available to do the job, and given that it's a UUP portfolio because no other party wanted the job, then who says that Mike Nesbitt can't do it, or Robbie Butler, or...
And Mike Nesbitt is a seasoned operator, isn't he? He's a seasoned politician. But it would take anybody going into a new role a period of time to grasp the issues. Swan had that advantage.
like any other job, but that doesn't mean to say you're condemned to do the job for life. And Robin Swan had done his turn. He'd been health minister since 2020. It wasn't his fault that the executive was collapsed, so he was only actually imposed for a couple of the last 4 years. We can have the debates over COVID and lockdown, and that's for another day, or for the inquiry as to whether that was legitimate or not. But no one can say that Robin Swan didn't give his all in terms of the policies that he pursued. And so, you know, why isn't he entitled to stand for Westminster in a seat that the UUP needs to gain? I mean, their only other possibility of a gain is for Manor and South Tyrone, where there's only 67 votes in it. But if Sinn Féin holds that, where else is the UUP looking? So why wouldn't you move from North Antrim down to South Antrim, have a go? And if the TUV reform do stand there and split the Unionist vote, then Robin Swan has a serious chance of winning. The Ulster Unionist Party would be foolish not to do that. And I know that might reduce health of party politics, but ultimately electoral politics do matter, and they matter particularly in terms of Westminster for the Ulster Unionist Party.
Let's see what our callers think this morning. Next up, an interview with the man at the centre of the UK-wide storm around him being threatened with arrest for being openly Jewish. The Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, says he is appalled by the way the Metropolitan Police treated this Jewish man during a pro-Palestinian demonstration in London. His name is Gideon Falter. He's the head of the campaign against anti-Semitism. And he was told by a police officer that he might prompt a reaction from protesters because he was being openly Jewish. The moment was recorded by the campaign and posted on social media.
You are quite openly Jewish. This is a pro-Palestinian march. I'm not accusing you of anything, but I'm worried about the reaction to your presence.
I've been speaking to Gideon Falter. He wants the head of the Met to resign. I asked him to talk me through what happened.
So I went to synagogue in the morning, and then traditionally, quite often, people in the Jewish community will go for a walk or go for lunch straight after, and I was out walking.
And you saw the protests. What was in your head?
You kind of see it coming towards you, and the thing that went through my head was, I've had 6 months of stories about what goes on at these protests, and some of it is pretty hairy. And the pavement I was on, which we were walking along, kind of would have pinned us against some buildings. So we decided, first thing was sort of there's a sort of moment where you think, should I hide my identity? Should I take off my kippah, my skull cap, or something like that? And the answer to that in my head was very much no, I shouldn't have to do that. And then we started just crossing over to the other pavement, which would have been a better place to be, and also in the direction that we were headed, and where we needed to be to get to where we were going to. And as we were doing that, I suddenly felt hands on me, and I looked around, and it was a police sergeant from the Met, who was pretty roughly sort of pulling me over back to the pavement I'd just come from. And he tells me that I look quite openly Jewish. My presence may antagonize the crowds. And basically, if I don't leave the area, I'm going to get arrested.
You said we. Who were you with?
I was with a few people. We'd been to synagogue in the morning, and we were walking.
And I've seen some people, and look, Twitter is a cesspit. I think everybody can agree with that. But some people on Twitter have been suggesting that some of the people that were with you have been to lots of counter protests before, which they were entitled to be if they were. But can we just clear that up? Had they been?
So I wasn't, and neither were any of the other people with me, part of the protest or any counter protest or anything like that. We were just people. And I should also say, there was nothing to mark us out differently from other Londoners, other than that we were Jewish, as in we didn't have any stickers, badges, placard signs, and also in terms of what we were doing, we were just walking. We weren't shouting any slogans, singing any songs, doing anything that would mark us out. And it was a busy Saturday. There were people walking in every which direction, crossing roads, walking up the street, down the street, and no one was having any kind of problem. The only people who the police decided they needed to deal with, as it were us.
you summarize what he said to you. Was this one singular officer interacting with you? I've seen the video, and it seems to be that one officer having the majority of the conversation with you.
No, there were a few different officers that I spoke to. I think the officer who most people have seen in the video was a sergeant. There were a couple of inspectors also that I spoke to. At least I think they were inspectors because they had the red epaulettes on, which I've since Googled. But they all pretty much said the same thing, which is that, you know, if I don't leave the area, then I'm going to be arrested. And it's unfortunately because I'm Jewish. And some of them, by the way, I should make it clear, I don't blame these frontline police officers. I disagree with a lot of what they've said. But they're being put in an impossible situation by their senior officers. There are too few of them to keep everybody safe. And some of the police officers, I think I sympathized an awful lot with, and some of the police officers I also felt sympathized an awful lot with me. I would say probably not the sergeant who we saw, but you know, I get that being a police officer on the front line is really difficult. And I actually spoke earlier with Rick Pryor, who's the chair of the Met Police Federation. And he and I both agree we're not happy with some of the decisions made by some of the frontline officers, but we're both aligned on the fact that the change that we need to see in the Met comes from the top, and it's not these frontline officers that we should be looking to for answers.
Look, it's absolutely outrageous. It's not me being in any way a biased BBC presenter to say that it is outrageous if you're asked to leave a street because of your religion. There's no one will agree with the principle of that. But in the reality of that situation, do you feel that that individual officer, while you profoundly disagreed with what he was asking you to do, do you think he was doing it for your safety?
I think, first of all, that probably is how he saw it. But I think that there would be a big difference. If I were walking along and I had a big flag or a sign saying, you know, I hate everything you stand for or whatever, you know, and I was amongst these protesters, then obviously that's a totally different situation. But if I'm just walking around being, as he put it, quite openly Jewish, then his job is to protect my right to be quite openly Jewish in whatever context. In the same way that if you see, let's say you saw a far right rally coming towards you and a police officer spies out of the corner of his eye that there's a black person walking down the street, the police officer's job is not to go and grab that black person, pull them roughly to the side of the road, and say, listen, mate, you're being quite openly black and you're going to antagonize people around here, so you'd best scarper or we're going to arrest you. That's inverse policing. The police's job is to protect minorities and their ability to live their life openly, regardless of people around them. And that's what they should be doing when these marches are taking place.
And that comes, as you've said, from decisions at the top to make sure that the police are adequately resourced on the day so that they can protect people like you and others. But given the situation that there was that day, had you have walked into that crowd, do you think it likely that you would have been attacked?
I don't know, because when we did cross the road, we eventually, the police agreed to escort us across the road. We've seen over the past 6 months that these marches are pretty gruesome in some ways. You see people who are walking along dressed as Hamas terrorists. You see swastikas on placards. You see people who, there's one placard which I've seen a few times actually, where there's a Star of David thrown in a bin and the caption next to it says, please keep the world clean. And I don't think it's hyperbole or exaggeration to say a placard like that wouldn't look out of place in, you know, 1930s Germany. And you also see the police keep saying that, you know, everything is fine. You see Mark Rowley touring the news studio saying, you know, quote, I'm going to enforce ruthlessly to the letter of the law. And yet, you know, calls for jihad, swastikas on placards, police officers keep finding what they call context to explain why that's okay. And the conclusion you start to come to is that actually there's nothing really that these police officers are going to do or that the Met Police are going to do to protect you. They're just going to keep allowing everything to happen.
And I want to talk about that, but just a little bit more about the actual situation on that day. Had you Gideon walked into that crowd unprotected by the police, if idiots had have attacked you, you know, venomous, nasty people had have attacked you because of your religion, the police could not have protected you because there wasn't enough of them. So was it the safe thing for them to say, please don't take that risk?
There are a couple of things in there. First of all is, are these marshes actually being policed properly? Are the police providing enough people? And the answer to that most definitely seems to be no. I mean, how on earth, let's say there were 100,000 football fans walking around, you know, police would put in place police officers in riot gear and everything else ready to deal with an emergency or a serious incident should one arise. Instead, what we're seeing is not that. We're seeing police officers massively outnumbered. We aren't seeing police who are able to deal with serious situations that arise. And yeah, I have an awful lot of sympathy for a frontline police officer who knows that there are an awful lot more of them than there are of him, and knows that if something kicks off, he's going to be in danger himself. And indeed, we've seen police officers hospitalized, but that I lay at the door of Mark Rowley and the commissioner of the Met.
But it was you that was going to be in danger, wasn't it?
Officers in that situation.
There is a school of thought, Gideon, that could go that if those police officers hadn't have cared about you, they would have just let you walk into it and they would have stood back.
They may have seen it that way, but the fact of the matter is that they also could have done what they ended up doing, which is just say, where are you trying to go, sir? So sorry that this is going on today. Yep, there are people who are probably going to shout abuse and all of the rest. We're just going to walk with you, make sure that you can get to where you're going to safely. And you say you want to cross the road, no problem, we'll walk you across the road. In the end, because I insisted, that's exactly what they did. And yes, people did shout abuse and there was some unpleasantness, but they were able to just walk me across the road and let me go where I was trying to get to. And that's what should have happened from the beginning. And I shouldn't have had to be treated like a criminal. I've got to tell you, you know, growing up Jewish in this country, you see the police quite a lot. When you leave synagogue, schools, Jewish schools, community centers, you know, because of the threat to the Jewish community in this country, you see the police a lot. And the two words that you grow up saying to the police the whole time, every time you see them, is thank you. And so for me, it was particularly jarring, having had only interactions with the police, you know, through my childhood, where you just say thank you to police. It was really, really jarring that since October 7th, there have now been these incidents where, and I found myself in the middle of one last Saturday, where I'm being treated like a criminal. I'm being treated like I'm the one who's causing a problem. Like basically I'm ruining everybody else's London because I've turned up being a Jew. And I just don't think that would happen, you know, and it certainly shouldn't happen. And, you know, I'd go back to the example, you know, if it was a far right march or any other kind of march, can you imagine an officer saying, you know, you're openly black, you're openly wearing a hijab, you're openly gay, you're openly in a wheelchair. I just can't imagine those words leaving an officer's mouth. I mean, and it wasn't just this one officer, as we were saying earlier. I spoke to quite a few officers, and they all seem to be more senior than the sergeant that you can see in the video. And they're all more or less saying the same thing. In fact, there's one video that we've posted on our social media at Anti-Semitism, which shows a police officer sort of shouting to the other police officers, if they come back this way, we're going to use Section 14 conditions and throw them in the pen. And I just can't imagine, I don't know what he meant by a pen, whether this is sort of police slang for something or whether there's literally a pen that they were planning to put me in. But what a way to treat someone who's done nothing other than walk in London being Jewish.
What did it feel like, honestly, when he said to you, you're being openly Jewish?
I, first of all, couldn't quite believe what was going on because it had all happened sort of, things moved quite quickly. But I felt a real sense of indignance. And I just felt I couldn't sort of back down from this. I've seen some footage that was posted earlier today that was taken by, Sky, or that Sky obtained, where at one point I actually sort of like test things out with the officer. And I say to him, look, if I take off this skull cap and I turn round the bag with my prayer shawl in it so that you can't see the Star of David, can I cross the road? And he said to me, no, because I don't have any confidence that you wouldn't put it back on. And, kind of coming out of it, you just think, wow, that actually happened. And a whole crowd of police officers stood round and agreed with that. And other senior officers were standing right there and also seemed to agree with it. And the other thing that really jarred me at the time that felt really bad was I was obviously surrounded with police officers. There were people who were marching, saw what was going on, and all they knew was that I was a Jew being spoken to by police. And they stopped marching, they stopped what they were doing, they gathered round and they started shouting things like disgusting, Nazi, lock him up. There was one person who was just repeatedly shouting scum, 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 scum. None of these people had a crowd of police officers around them. None of them were told to leave the area. None of them were threatened with arrest. I just thought, wow, this is completely on its head. And I actually felt, this could become a dangerous situation if I'm kept here by police. And I actually wonder if none of these people are being dealt with by police, how safe am I actually?
Well, one of the tests for the police, because they have apologised twice, the Met have apologised twice. I guess one of the tests for the Metropolitan Police, you could argue, is there is so much CCTV, there is so much video footage of that incident and of you being abused. Let's see if they do approach, if they do arrest anyone, if they do caution or warn anyone who was hurling abuse at you.
Well, I think actually that's probably the next thing that we'll be looking out for. You're absolutely right. We've got footage, and the Met, I believe, have footage as well. There were lots of people. Everybody sort of, the second this started, as you can imagine, unfortunately, it's just a sign of the times. But the second this started, everybody whipped out a smartphone. I had people shoving smartphones, within an inch of my face. And there is loads and loads of footage. There were policemen there with cameras. They must know what happened. They must have reviewed it all 1,000 times by now. And I want to see whether any of those people shouting abuse at me for being Jewish are actually, I haven't even seen the police issue a photo fit or a photo or anything saying, we're looking for this person. Do you know who it is? So, yeah, I hope that we're now going to see whether the police pass this test, which is, are they actually going to start looking at the perpetrators of the actual crimes that were taking place that day?
And if they don't, what does it say about the Met?
I think, unfortunately, it reinforces what we're saying. We've launched a petition for Sir Mark Rowley to go. And in the last few hours, it's been up. It's sort of already, it's thousands of signatures. I think it's just zooming past 6,000 signatures now. And the reason we've called for that is because this isn't some kind of one-off slip-up. Mark Rowley's had 6 months now to get this right. And had this happened in the early days when these marches started, you might understand that, the Met's navigating a new situation, hasn't quite got its game together. But this is 6 months on now, and what I think has gone wrong here is that the Met has decided that the easy route out is that there aren't that many Jews in Britain. And the easy route is to curtail the rights of law-abiding Jewish Londoners and sacrifice them essentially so that lawless mobs can do what they want to do. And so the big, you know, that's why we think there needs to be a new change of direction. It needs to come from the top. But I'm looking for the police to actually now take real action against the offenders who were shouting at me that day.
And if they did, would you stop calling for Rooley to go?
I don't think so, because all of this goes back to two things. One is that he hasn't actually provided his own officers with the resources they need to fight this properly and to actually deal with what goes on these marches. So they don't have enough officers to go in, grab someone who's doing the wrong thing, who's committing a criminal offence, and deal with them and arrest them then.
Is that not about government resourcing, though? The head of the Metropolitan Police doesn't decide how many police officers are on the ground during a protest.
But this is where the second thing comes in. The second thing is Mark Rowley the way that the law works is that if he wants to do something about these marches, and by do something, I mean either curtail them in some way or ban them altogether, he just has to ask the Home Secretary's permission, but he has to instigate that, particularly for a ban. He has to ask the Home Secretary. And the conditions that have to be met, the threshold that has to be met under law, is that the march has to be causing serious disruption to the life of a community. And they're also able to take into account the cumulative effect of these marches. And I would ask, if a Jewish person can't be in the vicinity of these marches safely, how much worse does it need to get before Mark Rowley thinks, right, this has now reached the threshold where it's causing serious disruption to the life of the community, and I'm going to ask the Home Secretary for powers, for permission to either massively curtail these marches, so that, you know, we're going to have, you know, smaller numbers of people, fewer marches, or just ban them altogether, because it's been going on every weekend now for months.
But what about, Gideon, equal in parallel to your right to walk across the road? What about the right to protest? What about those people who want to be on the street, want to express their democratic disgust at what Israel is doing? What about their rights to protest?
There are people who, look, if you take last Saturday, there were people there who were protesting with the Palestine Solidarity Campaign. There were also people there who were counter-protesting against Hamas and this appalling atrocity that Hamas committed. And, you know, obviously lots of different people, lots of different views. The right to protest is important. But when it comes to a point where, and actually there's something very important about this, none of the people shouting abuse at me, got any kind of pushback from other protesters, as far as I could hear. People shouting scum and all of the rest of it at me for being Jewish. No other protester came up to them and said, oh, you know, mate, I think you're making us look bad. Can you stop it? Even that, nothing. And I think that...
But they can't be, guilty by association, can they?
Well, this is the thing. I think that if you're the organiser of a protest, and in weeks 1, 2, 3, 4, and it goes on for 6 months, every single week, you've got people shouting anti-Semitic abuse, glorifying terrorism, shouting these anti-Semitic chants and all of the rest of it. And you as the organizer never deal with it properly. And the other people on the march are quite happy to come along week after week and never deal with it properly. Then unfortunately, I think you do lose the right to protest at some point, because your rights to protest have to be balanced with the rights of, for example, people like me to be Jewish freely in London.
So do you think these protests should be banned outright?
I think we've reached that point now. And I'd like to see Mark Rowley ask the Home Secretary's permission. But he hasn't done it. And he also hasn't imposed sufficient conditions on the marches. He hasn't shrunk down their size or said, no, you can't do routes that block up the whole of London. You've got to take smaller routes and all the rest of it. And I think that's one of the reasons he should go now. He just hasn't taken the matter in hand.
You being challenged by those police officers for being openly Jewish is, as I've said to the vast majority of people listening to this, ludicrous and abhorrent. The Prime Minister has criticised it as well. But to call for the head of the Metropolitan Police to resign because he's not banning a protest, and you know that there is a legitimate, valid argument to protect the right to protest. The freedom to protest is a right that we might all want at some stage in our lives. Are you sure you're pitching the right reason for him to go?
Yeah, I think because no right is absolute. There is no right in the world that you can say, for example, you know, my right to swing an axe means that I can kill people if they happen to stand in my way. You know, that no right is absolute. And the right to protest is balanced in this country by the need to by the need to ensure that your protest doesn't unduly, consistently put a minority such as Jews in danger.
Are you frightened being in Britain at the moment because of your religion? Do you feel in danger?
I think that a lot of British people, British Jews do. Feel endangered at the moment. I think that 90% of British Jews, according to our polling, are now avoiding city centres when these marches are taking place, and 69% of British Jews feel the need to hide their identity whilst in public.
And are you ever tempted to remove any sign of your religion?
I had a chat recently with somebody who said to me, Gideon, is it really the end of the world if Jews have to hide their identity or stay out of London at weekends for the next few months? And I said, yeah, it's the end of a world that has existed since the Battle of Cable Street in 1936, when the Jewish community and our allies saw off the British Union of Fascists. And ever since then, Jews have been able to walk the streets and go wherever we please. And that has been the reality for Jews in this country since. And I think we forsake that at our peril.
So, Gideon, what's next for you?
We've got to carry on fighting for our rights in this country. This Saturday, actually, I'm going to go for a walk. We're asking people, Jewish and not Jewish, to come with us, and we'll walk where we please in central London. It's called Walk Together, and that's at antisemitism.org/walktogether. But we need to see change from the top of the Met, and we need to see that the Jewish community in this country is going to be kept safe. And I just don't think it's a lot to ask to be able to walk the streets whilst quite openly Jewish without facing consequences from the police.
Gideon, thank you very much indeed for speaking to me.
Good morning. The PSNI have told The Nolan Show they have launched an investigation into a video circulating on social media which appears to show a group of people in a bar singing a song celebrating IRA shootings. The song is to the tune of This Old Man. It references provos shooting people with guns. There's chanting of Send Those British Bees Home and Up the Ra. The question is, when was it filmed? The PSNI understand that it may have been at least a few months ago, but they are investigating. The other question, of course, is where was it filmed? Who are the people who are readily seen in this video? Who are they? Where were they? What type of club were they in? The TV leader, Jim Allister, has requested an opportunity to speak in the Assembly Chamber about this later today. Let's hear from Jim, but first let's hear some of this video which you may very well find upsetting. Well, we now know a police investigation has been launched into this. The TV leader, Jim Allister, with us this morning. As you hear that, Jim, mystery surrounds when and where this happened.
It does, but someone knows, and it's up to the police to find out, because it's quite clear that this was a very open glorification of the brutal, brutal murders of the IRA. You just have to listen to the lyrics to find how stomach-churning and disgusting this is. And you know, it comes to the last one. It says, this old man, he shot 10. Give us a gun and we'll do it again. So it's quite clear that it is a deliberate and provocative criminal glorification of terrorism. And complaints have now been made to the police. They must thoroughly investigate this. We know the job they did in investigating the disgusting video on Makaima Makaribi. I expect no less now. I expect where this took place to become public. I expect those who, if there's any guilt about it, who were there to own up to it. This was someone's club. This was maybe a sporting organisation, maybe a political club, who knows. But whoever it was, they need to come clean, because this is something so disgusting as to be beyond any defence. And so I do believe that the police must now act and act with vigour, as they did in the previous case, and let's see people in court for this criminal glorification of terrorism.
Jim, the faces are visible on the video. It's our understanding that the police believe that this video could be at least a number of months old. There's so much around. There's so much disgusting video around on Twitter. Why has this caught your attention?
Well, because I think of the lyrics, because of the open and blatant glorification of IRA terrorism. It's about the provos. They cite that in the lyrics and they endorse and look for more. So it's something which, particularly coming off the back of the very chilling inquest outcome in King's Mills, where 10 people were shot dead by the provos, and then to have people singing about, you know, this old man, he shot 10, give us a gun and we'll do it again, is, I think, something which most people with any sense of morality will recoil from. And I do say strongly again, whoever's club that was, and there are many suggestions.
And that will be so relevant, won't it? That will be relevant. Where was this? Who allowed it to happen? What type of club was it?
Yes, who allowed it to happen? Why nobody intervened? Why, indeed, it was met with such hysterical applause as to endorse every last lyric that was contained. So whoever's club that was, they have a bounden duty, surely, unless they are openly aligned to supporting murder and terrorism. They have a bounden duty to come forward and to help the police in this inquiry. And let's see who they are. You know, I think that will be very telling. Let's see whose club this is, and let's see just whether it matches up with some of the public utterances of organisations, or whether this is another side, a very dark side, which they need to now address and disown. And they need to help the police in bringing those to justice who were involved.
Jim, very quickly, in other matters this morning, we've been talking about Robin Swan's decision to seek a Westminster role and leave the health role. Given how big that role is in Northern Ireland, health and waiting lists, what's your reaction to his decision?
Well, I think at a number of levels it's very surprising, because, you know, Robin took this job knowing that he was intending to stand for Westminster. So the question is, why did he take it? But I think the other issue is, now that he's taken that stand, I think it puts the ball very much with other executive ministers like Naomi Long, who may be contemplating a run at Westminster. You know, Robin has wanted to set the marker. Are they going to step up to that mark? Are they going to try and juggle both jobs, hold the salary for a minister while at the same time seeking another job?
Well, you don't know that, do you?
No, I say it puts it up to them, and let's see what they do. I think it also is indicative that most politicians in Northern Ireland know that the Toy Town Assembly and executive at Stormont is as nothing compared to the Mother of Parliaments, and that's why they'd rather be there.
I see that Alex Cain over the weekend was writing about you, the commentator Alex Cain, suggesting that because of your age and everything that and everything that goes with it, this could be your last hurrah if you're not successful.
They wish. I've heard that before. I'll not hold my experience against anyone who's less experienced.
So do you intend to go on forever or what?
No one goes on forever, Stephen. We're all very mortal and none of us know the day. But I've been blessed with good health and that's something in which I'm very thankful.
Are you still enjoying it?
I do enjoy it. It has its frustrations, of course, when you see the country go the wrong way, as it has under this iniquitous protocol, and you see Northern Ireland ushered from being a proper part of the United Kingdom into a condominium part ruled by foreign law and detached from the United Kingdom, of course. That's very frustrating, but then that also fires me to want to try and do something about that.
Okay. Jim, nice to talk to you. Thanks very much. Gideon Falter, who tried to cross the road in the middle of the Palestinian protests at the weekend, who's just been on Nolan over the last half hour or so, very much provoking you to call us this morning, be it in support of him or not. David in Belfast. Morning, David.
Morning, Stephen. I'd like to point out, Stephen, you see, if you look at the footage there, when that man, and the people with him are trying to make an attempt to cross through that demonstration.
Yes.
And my point is, Stephen, is that if that policeman hadn't have made that decision, there would have been chaos. That, I mean, that's like, say, an orange parade walking down the road and a half a dozen guys walking up with, say, tricolour badges or something and they're wanting to walk through them. Would that be justified? Would that be anti-Catholic? Would that be anti-nationalist? No, it would have been taken on the merits of what the situation was.
But do you not differentiate between someone's allegiance to a football team and someone's religion? Their religion being part of their identity, their religion being so important to their everyday life. So Stephen, what do you want this man to do? Hide his religion?
No, but nobody mentioned his religion. It was him that was mentioning his religion.
No, the police officer. No. That's not true. So the police officer.
The police officer mentioned it, yes.
At the heart of this story is the fact that the Metropolitan Police officer said, you're being openly Jewish, and that will be provocative to the Palestinian protesters.
That police officer was being openly factual. He was being openly Jewish. The policeman, and I would assume, knew exactly what his intentions were, was to walk through that parade to agitate, to get someone to strike him
or
whatever.
You don't know that.
Well, why would you want to do that?
Well, we all cross roads every day, don't we?
Yeah, Stephen, but what I'm saying is he knew what that Palestinian demonstration was for. He knew exactly what he was wanting to do, and he's achieved it. He achieved the fact that he's now on national TV, on national radio, trying to condemn people who want... He said something about
that he has
a right to walk. Well, the Palestinians have a right to live, Stephen.
If we take this to its logical end, if you're suggesting that this man shouldn't have crossed that road because there was Palestinian protests there, then what if there are Palestinian protests all over the roads on a particular day? What do you do if you're Jewish? Do you stay at home?
Well, listen,
do you not go out? Are there no-go areas depending on what protest is
around? If I'm walking down a road, Stephen, and I want to get to the other side, but there's cars driving up and down, I'll have to wait until those cars pass. Isn't that correct?
Right.
So really, at the end of the day, and plus the fact, I mean, if that demonstration was given permission to walk down that street,
so
if he's walking across that street, so is that not jaywalking?
So if there is a, for goodness sake, so if there is well, a,
you know,
if
let's there, take it as far there, as he wants to take it.
If there is some far-right protest against black people, what do black people do? Do they take alternative routes too?
Listen, this isn't nothing to do with
And if there are if there are protests against gay people, do all gay people stay at home certain days of the week? Like, where does this end?
What was the demonstration against, Stephen? You're trying to say it's against a particular people. This was a march in support of the Palestinian people who are being killed on a daily basis, women and children.
Why can't those Palestinian protesters who have every right to their right to protest, why can't that sit alongside the person who has a right to walk on the streets of the UK?
Certainly, he could have joined the march to walk along with them and support. Yeah, he could have done that. He could have quite said, "I'm no problem. I'm with you. I'm against all the killings, the murders that's happening in Palestine.
Well,
and we need peace in that country." Well, and he could have walked along with them.
Have a listen to Stephen Lisburn here. Morning, Steve.
Good morning, Stephen.
Go ahead.
I know, it's just, I'm glad you brought that to light there. It's obviously another version of the two-tier policing that we've seen. I've watched many of videos live and recorded of the policing just turning a blind eye to these Palestinian marches and what they're carrying. And obviously the abuse that they're giving to other people, the flags that they're flying. You know, so, I mean, it's just unreal. And
there are many genuine protesters who find what Israel is doing abhorrent, who have every right to be on the streets of London, Steve.
Who says they haven't? But why do they have to then give the abuse out to others who are not with them? You know, with these banners that they're displaying, you know, if so-called far right or ordinary people had banners that was given abuse and different things offensive, you know, the police would be straight in there and they'd be taking them off them. So we're seeing that. I mean, I'll give you a prime example, and I can't believe that you haven't even had it on your show. This is the first thing in the mainland that I think you've brought up. So it's fair to say that Tommy Robinson was sitting in a restaurant having his breakfast, doing nothing. He was there to report on the march, and the police, heavily handed, went in, trailed him away from having his breakfast, pepper sprayed him, and arrested him.
I have no idea about that.
I know you don't, because you don't want to report on that. That's the problem.
Okay.
I mean, why have you not reported on it?
Because I don't know about it. I'd have to go and look it up.
Now, it's all over the place now. You're just telling lies.
Right, okay.
That man
has suggested something there, and he's 100%. There should be no flags, no banners, any parades.
And Epstein is with us this morning, as is the People Before Profit MLA, Jerry Carroll. Angela's journalist and commentator. Morning, Angela.
Good morning.
Good morning, good morning. Good morning, Jerry.
Morning, Stephen.
So, Jerry, did the police call it right when they threatened to arrest that man because he was being openly Jewish beside a Palestinian protest?
Well, I'm not here to defend the Met, Stephen, which they have a really long history and shameful history of institutional racism. I mean, today is actually Stephen Lawrence Day. Let's not forget about their role in the aftermath of his brutal murder, and they were called institutionally racist. In 2005, Met murdered a Brazilian man, John George de Menezes, who they thought was a bomber. So they've got a long history of racism and racist incidents. So I'm not here to defend them. But I think I have to say, Stephen, I think we're in a strange place where peace marches and marches explicitly calling for an end to war, and which have people of all backgrounds, you know, including people who are Muslim, people who are Jewish, people who are Christian, and people of no religion, that those are called hate marches by the government and by implication perhaps by the actions of this police officer. We have had large numbers of people out in the streets, hundreds of thousands, I think in some cases maybe millions out in the streets, pretty much without any incident at all. And I think it's very, very concerning that we're going down this path of potentially renaming them as hate marches or marches that are, you know, stoking division or whatever.
Answer.
Hi. I think what makes them hate marches are the people that behave hatefully on them. I think if these had been peaceful protests where there had been examples of those glorifying Hamas, waving swastikas, shouting out all sorts of anti-Semitic slurs, and behaving in a way that is demonstrably intimidating, not just to Jewish people. I have a lot of non-Jewish friends in central London who are fed up because they feel that they have lost control of their city and they can't move where they want to. I want the war to end in Gaza. I am Jewish. The Israeli government's enemy is not the people of Gaza. It's Hamas, the terrorist organization, the death cult that started this. And nobody wants a single innocent life lost. I think on that we can all agree. And on that, people have the right to express their political views. But what is this country coming to when somebody who is manifestly Jewish, in this case because he's wearing a Jewish skull cap, a kippah as they call it, wants to cross the street in a home city where he pays his taxes, where he's law-abiding, where he contributes to the public purse. We live in a free society, and he is told that because he is openly Jewish, that he shouldn't go there.
But
now,
this
is an important point. Please let me just finish the point if you ask me to speak. Is I appreciate that the police officer's words were clumsy and stupid, and it may well be that his first thought was safety, in a way that people clumsily say to women, don't walk down a dark street with a short skirt. You know, it is a woman's right to walk down a street with a dark skirt. If she wants to expose herself to greater risk, it's still an attacker who is 100% guilty if he attacks her or she attacks her. It is not how somebody dresses. And it is the same thing here. And what's happened is that because it's happened against a kind of background of so-called soft policing, only the other week where somebody who was waving a swastika was told, you know, they didn't castigate the person doing this because a swastika has to be seen in context. A swastika is inextricably linked with the Third Reich and the murder of millions of Jewish people.
We think at home this morning. Andrew in Belfast. Morning, Andrew.
Hi, Stephen.
Morning.
There's a number of facets to this whole thing. I don't want to go into the Met issue because I think Gideon expressed his concerns very, very eloquently. The point I want to make is that so many anti-Zionists deny being anti-Semitic. So why was a Jewish man with his kippah on, walking down the street, called scum and a Nazi?
Absolutely.
I'm not saying everybody on that parade was or is anti-Semitic, but I think the whole movement, the pro-Palestinian movement, is not a pro-Palestinian movement. It's an anti-Zionist movement. It's an anti-Semitic movement. And they tried to demonize Jewish people throughout the world. And what we've got to remember is that Israel is embarked, not through choice, on a war against Hamas. And the Hamas charter calls for the death of Jews everywhere in the world. And this is being ignored by 90% of people.
Jerry?
Yeah, well, I think it's absolute nonsense, Stephen, for your caller to try and paint the pro-Palestine solidarity movement as anti-Semitic. I mean, Zionism is a political ideology which emerged really towards the end of the 19th century, which you know, many people challenge. Many people are Zionists who are Christian. And, you know, different sort of religions and ideologies. So the idea of conflating, criticizing Zionism as a political ideology, conflating that with being anti-Semitic it's nonsense. It's a fabrication. It's not true whatsoever. And I also want to challenge Steve and Angela's point that these protests have been chanting anti-Semitic slogans. I mean, I don't know if she's any specific examples, but if she's referring to From the River to the Sea, which is regularly used by the Tories.
Gideon Falter says he was called scum.
I didn't say that. He may well have been, and that's something else. But in terms of the slogans being shouted out, I mean, From the River to the Sea is not an anti-Semitic slogan. The government have tried to jump on that to say that this is an anti-Semitic
campaign. Yes, Angela, very briefly, you can respond.
It's criticizing.
Possibly as the only Jewish person in discussion, I'm not asking you to declare your religion. Let me tell you, and I have family and friends in Israel, From the River to the Sea, Palestine Will Be Free is an implicit call out to eradicate everybody who lives in between, from the Jordanian River to the Mediterranean. That's eradicating the only Jewish state in the world. And Zionism is the right for Jewish people to self-determination, to a state. It is anti-Semitic when you conflate the two, when you start being called Zionazis. And Zionism has been taken over as a concept.
Okay.
There is no right. I just wanted to finish and say one thing. I am Jewish, British, and I am proud to be so. I want to walk anywhere in Northern Ireland. I want to walk anywhere in England, Scotland, and Wales and be Jewish. And if I want to wear a big Star of David on my head, I should be allowed to.
Angela, thank you. Jerry Carroll, thank you very much. Our last story of the day, the justice system in Northern Ireland is at tipping point and victims could face being let down. This is what Northern Ireland's Director of Public Prosecution, Stephen Herron, has told the BBC in an interview with our crime and justice correspondent, Julian O'Neill. The Belfast Telegraph's crime correspondent, Alison Morris, is with us this morning. So Mr. Herron says he needs more money. Who doesn't, Alison?
Well, exactly. I mean, every department needs more money, but justice has been in crisis for quite some time. And we know that the backlog in the courts, which was obviously exacerbated by COVID, but was pretty dire before then, is leading to some people withdrawing their statements before their cases come to court. And that's particularly sensitive when you come to allegations of sexual assault, rape and historic sex abuse. And we know that from the Gillen Review, that one of the reasons why people gave us a reason for why they withdrew from the process before it reached trial was because of the length of time it was taken to come to trial. And that's obviously one of the things that Stephen Herron had addressed in this interview. He had spoken about the fact that there was an increase in reports of sex abuse crimes and that he doesn't have enough solicitors, lawyers working in the prosecution office to deal with those files.
There's another story within this story, and it is what you've just touched upon, this comment that there's been an upsurge in sexual offences and domestic abuse cases. Does that mean that do we know if it means that there has been an increase in the instances of it happening, that more people are committing those crimes or more victims are prepared to come forward?
It is the fact that more victims are coming forward. We've seen a real increase. It happens, you know, around sort of, I suppose, high profile cases, but also that encourages people to come forward, but also just people. I think that because there's more conversations around it, there's more groups that are working with people who are victims of sex abuse, that we are seeing more people coming forward. Some people coming forward years after, and we've seen that in terms of the church sex abuse scandals and things like that, where people didn't come forward till many years afterwards. And, you know, quite a few years ago, I was up doing a tour around the prison in Macabre, and I know you've spent time in Macabre, and they've actually had the ADAPT part of the prison to deal with the growing aging population, and many of them would be people who've been convicted of historic sex crimes. So it has a whole knock-on effect in the justice system across. So it's sort of, I suppose, a positive story within a negative story, and the fact that people do feel more confident to come forward.
If Stephen Herron doesn't get the $7 million he's asking for, what does that mean for us and our justice system?
Well, he's talking about that he needs another 20 lawyers because of all the staff that work within the PPS, not all of them are able to assess these files and say, so what happens is, you know, the prosecutor or lawyer gets this file, they look through it, they say, is there enough to prosecute here? Well, possibly not, but we can go back to the police and can ask them, can you go and check that? Can you get another statement from this? You know, they're the people then who adapt the files and make it then prepared and ready for court, and that is then what gets the case prepared to the point where it can go to court. If it isn't, there's delays, and in terms of those delays, if you can imagine that if you are the victim of a crime, that is bad enough and you have to deal with the trauma of that. And then, you know, there's going to be a court case and you have to prepare yourself that you're going to have to give evidence in that. But if that court case keeps getting delayed and delayed and delayed indefinitely, you can see how that drags that trauma out. And also, remember, people are innocent until proven guilty. There are people who are innocent who are accused of crimes who are also having to wait considerable amount of time to be found not guilty when the case actually comes to court. So it is imperative. And you know, Judge Gillen, when he did the Gillen Review, he pointed out to the fact that delays are that, you know, they are one of the biggest hurdles in trying to get people to stick with that process.
Alison, thanks as always. That's Alison Morris from the Belfast Telegraph. That's it from the Nolan Show for today. Well, that's partly it. You can listen to the programme again on BBC Sounds, or indeed you can continue talking to me on Twitter. That's at Stephen Nolan. Thanks for your company today. Have a good day. Is it raining outside, Blue M? And we shorts, but we half sleeve t-shirt. They're telling me in here I look like an ice cream man. See you in the morning. Bye bye.
In the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet at Stephen Nolan.